From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. You're hearing my voice, so obviously that means there's no Hunter, and no, it's not a flashback from when I would do the intro, but then I got lazy and Hunter did it. But he ain't here this week, so he's pretending to be Alec Baldwin. If you watch the old SNL skit. No, not about Trump, but yeah, the other famous Alec Baldwin skit. But anyway, that doesn't matter. Got John here. How you going, brother?
Eh, pretty good.
All right. What we're discussing this week, the lost art of the novelization of the, what would you say, John? In the 70s they started, didn't they? Around about Star Wars and all that sort of stuff?
Well, I was looking it up on Wikipedia, that unquestionable source.
Yeah.
And they were saying it went back as far as London After Midnight in the 1920s.
Good heavens.
And it says one of the first talking movies to be novelized is King Kong. And I do remember that was still in print in the 70s because of the De Laurentiis film.
Okay.
That they had issued. The King Kong novelization was constantly reprinted. It's probably still in print today. It's not something I collect much. Although last year, as I think I brought up on the show, I did read the Jaws 2 novelization because it was based on the first script, which was a bit different from what they filmed. So
yeah. So the novelization is our topic for this week. No movies. John and I were going to do a film, knowing that Hunter wasn't going to be here. But then I was going through my bookshelf the other day, and I thought, novelizations. No one really touches upon those things, you know, in a audio form, or in a podcast form, I should say, anyway. And I thought it'd be an interesting thing, because I'm sure, but Hunter being younger than us, it probably wasn't around his time, but it definitely was for you and I.
Yeah, it's faded out lately, I think. They mentioned that, like, the novelization of Godzilla, the 2014 version, was actually on the New York Times bestseller list. So I guess they still do them a bit. I don't go into bookstores too often. Books are actually too expensive to buy new.
Yeah, that's the thing. I knew you're a pretty voracious reader, so I thought these are something you definitely would have read in your time.
Yeah, I've read a few. I used to read some in high school because a lot of times they would always contain scenes that didn't make it into the final cut of the film released. And a lot of times that was the only way to check the dialogue before the VHS release. Platoon. Well, I remember my friend got the novelization of Platoon, and we were reading the at the time really blue dialogue that's in the film. And, one way to double check the dialogue was to look at the novelization, because it wasn't going to be on video for another 6 months. Back then, the windows for videotape were a lot longer how they are today. I mean, now it's almost like the following month, but back then it could take like half a year before it was released on videotape.
Yeah, I remember clearly Rambo 2 was 9 months, I think, from the day of release to the day of home video release.
Yeah, like cable TV was always a year, but like VHS release was always like 6 months.
Yeah,
at least minimum of 6 months. Like they had to max out second run. You know, they still made money in second run theaters back then, they could run for months. And Rambo was a good example of that. That sucker made so much money back then.
Yeah, I remember that
back in the day.
Sure did. But I was a big fan of novelizations. I remember the first one I ever picked up was The Terminator by Sean Hudson.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I really liked that quite a bit. Then I picked up Ghostbusters novelization. Uh-huh. And then a few more along the way, I picked up the Halloween one. Now, this one's interesting, written by Curtis Richards based on the screenplay by John Carpenter and Deborah Hill. Mm-hmm. What he had done was add scenes, so flesh out the story a bit more about Michael's past, you know, back in the sanitarium.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting, because I remember watching the film again after I'd read the book. I go, where's the part where he does this to the security guard? I'm like, oh, okay. I think they may have actually lifted it from the book and put it into Halloween Resurrection, which is a terrible movie. But I would have to go back and read the book or listen to the book. I'll get to that later on.
Right. It's funny because I read an interview with the guy who was Curtis Richards. It was actually Richard Curtis, who later became a respected literary agent for horror novelists.
Really?
And I think he was even Harlan Ellison's agent at one point. But yeah, Richard Curtis got it as a quickie writing job, and he just like – I think he saw a rough cut of the film and maybe he had the script and he just added his own stuff because he's given a lot of freedom. That was an independent release from Compass International. So He didn't have to worry about a George Lucas type of, tight rein on the manuscript. So he just wrote it and it was released. It was a collector's item for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think they brought it back in print. It's funny how a lot of that stuff, like, was the Mad Max novelization supposedly has a lot of information around the environment of that futuristic world.
I'm going to bring up Mad Max very soon.
Right, right.
Yeah, I'll get
you. And but also like Dennis Etchison, I think was his name, was a horror novelist that wrote the novelizations for the next two Halloween movies, like Halloween 2 and Halloween 3. And he apparently, I don't know if his Halloween 3 is based more on the Nigel Neal script that wasn't really used completely for the final version.
Yeah, I spent forever and ever and ever seeking out those two books, Halloween 2 and 3, and they just became impossible in the end. But I did find them, but not in written form, which I'll get to later on. Again, you think I'm being very cryptic about this, but I will explain later what I'm talking about. See, it's odd. You know, we talk about vinyl sometimes. Obviously, Hannah talks about vinyl being a big fan of collecting that stuff. And how it's making now a comeback. I was thinking to myself the other day, do you think the novelization will make a comeback? And I came to the conclusion, I think the answer will be no, because people are lazy these days. They don't want to read.
No, people really don't want to read. It's a strange thing. Although, kids love Harry Potter, and they seem to be reading more than they did when I was young.
Yeah.
You know, because they love, well, not just Harry Potter, but like some of this other stuff too that's big. And it's almost like the young adult novel has made a comeback. But I don't know if these kids are going to progress into reading actual books. And, I think the people who read novelizations were people who were voracious readers like myself, but they also were big movie buffs. And you didn't have that home video advantage back then. So if you wanted to relive a movie, you basically had to read the book or fill in gaps of something you missed. Like if you went to the bathroom or went to get popcorn back then, the novelization was a way to fill in gaps on stuff. Like I know I remember the Star Wars novelization being huge, and it was actually written by Alan Dean Foster, who is a up and coming sci-fi writer at the time.
Yeah.
But it was credited to George Lucas. Like he wrote this.
Of course, it was novelization.
Yeah. And then Foster wrote a sequel, Splinter in the Mind's Eye, which was actually based on a script treatment he had developed in case Star Wars made enough money to justify a low-budget sequel, but not necessarily a big-budget sequel, and that's what Splinter in the Mind's Eye was. And Foster had been writing novelizations, I think, as far back as like the early 70s. He did one. There was a Italian female Tarzan ripoff. I guess it'd be a Sheena, Queen of the Jungle ripoff, but it was called Leanne, the Jungle Goddess. And he wrote the novelization based on not seeing the film, but looking at like the Frank Frazetta painting, reading the press kit. they commissioned a great looking Frank Frazetta painting for the poster art, but I don't even know if Foster sat through like the dubbed version to write the novelization. So, but yeah, that's one of his famous early gigs. He also did the Dark Star novelization when Jack Harris released it.
Yeah, well, if you thought the novelization was dead, I mean, the Expanded Universe books, I'm going to take a guess, are dead and gone. Like this Star Wars Expanded Universe, they may still be around. I don't know.
Yeah, people do read those. That's the weird thing is, like when I was a kid and you went, and let's say you went to the science fiction section of Walden Books, or B. Dalton, you saw a lot of classics and new sci-fi novels issued, and the actual, like, your Star Trek tie-in stuff or the Star Wars tie-in stuff was very limited.
And your Blade Runner ones as well. There was about four or five Blade Runner extended.
Yeah, now that's all it is. You go to a science fiction section, I would say, I'd take a wild guess and say 70% is probably tie-in stuff to other media. It's not like, there's your Edgar Rice Burroughs standards and your Isaac Asimovs or your Jack Vance. Now it's basically Star Trek. An entire two rows of shelves will be for like Star Trek novels. That's such a big industry, which is weird to me because I'm like, I have no interest in spin-off novels of something that's already visualized for me on television.
Well, that lies a contentious issue amongst fans of Star Trek, and Craig Cohen, he would know more than anybody about this sort of stuff. Right. Do you class the Expanded Universe novels as canon in the Star Trek universe? Or even Star Wars, I should say. Jedi Cole would know this. I actually should have asked Cole, but I didn't get time. Do you class these books as canon? Some will say yes, and some will be vehemently saying no.
My guess is the fans will dispute it all the time on their forums and message boards.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there'll be a lot of screaming match with all caps and a picture of Yoda fighting with a picture of Darth Maul or someone like that. I don't know.
Kylo Ren 79 says no, not canon. You know, and I would think that like what they've done with the Star Wars films, they've probably junked all the Star Wars novels and comic book material that guys like Timothy Zahn and my friend Mike Barron had developed for the Star Wars franchise. It's probably like, screw all that shit.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't count. Not canon. You know?
Yeah. But I recently became sort of enamored with novelizations again, but going to a thrift store and picking up... I did pick up the first 5 Star Trek books for $2 for the lot, I think it was. Or $2.50, I think it was $2.50 for all 5. And I picked up Universal Soldier novelization for $1 and a Starsky and Hutch TV script, I believe it was. Or no, Starsky and Hutch 2 was the book. I don't remember the author of. Not taking the time to check out who it was. And that was 50 cents. I thought, I mean, this is cheap entertainment. I've got this book I can read here. Okay, yeah, the Starsky and Hutch book's only like a couple hundred pages, but, I mean, it's going to keep you entertained for at least 3 or 4 hours, you know, if not a bit more. Depends on the speed that you read. I mean, probably you, it'll be, what, 3 minutes to go through a couple hundred pages.
It takes me about an hour and a half to read like 150 page.
I got to know. You've got to, if you want to do it off air, just give me the winning formula to reading these books fast.
You know, it depends on the writer, because I find if I read old books by, like, H.P. Lovecraft or even Edgar Rice Burroughs, or those tend to go a little slower. And but with these kind of large print books, they're not written with complex writing style or prose, and I can just zip through them a lot quicker.
So you're looking for keywords, basically?
No, I think when I can read a simple prose, like, let's say a 70s pinnacle action novel, like a Mack Bolan or The Executioner or The Destroyer, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Those I tend to go through quick. What I've noticed is, like, I've decided to start reading, this is funny, adult westerns. So I found a long arm novel because a screenwriter friend of mine highly recommended the long arm novels. And there's, like, if you're not familiar with these, there's like 400 volumes. And they were all written under a house name. They probably had like 10 different ghostwriters contributing to them.
Yeah.
And they were basically westerns with sex scenes. And if you read your Louis L'Amour's or your Zane Grey's, your classic westerns, even if you read Larry McMurtry, there's not really much in terms of sex scenes. And so these long arms were kind of like James Bond novels in the West. So, you know, he's using his dick as much as his gun, basically. You know, it's just... You know, Western novels with sex scenes is all it is. And the adult novel or the adult Western was a big booming paperback genre in the late 70s and throughout the 80s. And, I mean, they're probably just read by dirty old men. That was probably the intended audience. It was to get that equivalent of the romance novel. Well, I started reading one of the long arms. I found one at a used bookstore Sunday and picked up. It was a double novel reprinting 2 early books in one volume, and I started reading it, and surprisingly, I'm not zipping through it because it's written despite the adult Western content. They didn't simplify the writing. It's actually written with that Western prose, you know, describing the environment and, you know, every little thing about the Western town. So I'm not going to read that as quick as, I might read a Destroyer novel or even a James Bond novel.
Oh, okay.
I found I can go through Fleming's stuff quick because I don't have to think about what he's describing. If he describes Bond gets into a Volvo, then I know what that is, you know. But if he drives a Mercedes, I know exactly what, or he's drinking a martini, I don't need much reference. But with Western stuff, you know, Western writers actually research this stuff and they'll make references to things that aren't around anymore. So it takes a little more thought. Like Hunter and I have discussed, we can't really get into Fu Manchu, the Sax Rohmer books, because they're written in this like 1920s prose that basically writers like Ernest Hemingway kind of killed. You know, this very stuffy prose, you know, like they're trying to write like Conan Doyle. And Sherlock Holmes stories, there's another thing. Those take a little tougher for me to get through because I have to sometimes look up references because I don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Because they're talking about the London of his day, which was contemporary, and he made a reference knowing his readers would know what it meant, but I don't know about London of 1895, so I have to look it up.
I guess all you know would be about the Jack the Ripper murders and...
Right, exactly. I only know what I've seen
everywhere in...
what I've seen in Hammer films, basically, and rip-offs of Hammer films.
Pretty much,
and,
yeah.
It's funny because you mentioned Sean Hudson writing the Terminator novelization, and that had a funny rep because I guess he put pretty intense sex scenes in his novelization. And that's not in the American novelization, which I think was by another writer. I think it was by somebody like Randall Wallace or somebody like that, or Randall Franks. Like, yeah, we got a totally different novelization over here. Funny thing is I found the Sean Hudson novelization at a garage sale in Laramie, Wyoming, of all places. But I still have not read it. Like, I haven't been in a hurry to read that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I've still got mine on the Terminator, but I know I still do have others on there. Like that Halloween one, which is, oh, God, looks like it's been to hell and back. You know, about six times over. It's just, or 666 times over. It's very beaten up, but...
Well, with Sean Hudson, he wrote, I think he recently did some Hammer novelizations of the old Hammer movies because somehow those sell to fans.
All I remember was on the, I think it was on the front of the book, it says from the author of Squirm. I'm thinking, what the hell is Squirm? I've never heard of it. But yeah, I know he did quote Motley Crue from their song, or their intro in the beginning, in the front page or the inside page there.
Oh, really?
For he whom they fear awaits you. And it says Motley Crue on there. I'm like, oh, it's pretty cool. Didn't know who Motley Crue at the time. I didn't get to the crew until about a year or so later, about 85. Right. But, yeah.
Well, Sean was he was one of those splatterpunk novelists, I think they were nicknamed. And they tended to quote rock singers or more current heavy metal bands.
Oh, okay.
Whereas, you know, where somebody like Stephen King, the heaviest he might quote was Blue Oyster Cult. You know.
Don't Fear the Reaper.
Right. Nothing wrong with that, but it was kind of obvious, like, you know, if you're going to quote something, don't make it so obvious and blatant, you know. Hey, born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen, you know.
So why do you think the novelization is pretty much petered out and died?
I think it's because of DVD.
Yeah.
And we've got more of a, although I see a sort of curve against this, is it's a trending against it. But, you know, we had a DVD collector's market where you owned your favorite movies on the shelf. And I see that being discouraged in the age of streaming. And I think there's something to, you know, you always hear about the hoarding TV shows where they,
yep.
you know, some woman who saved every newspaper and they're about to collapse on
every
her.
Every McDonald's wrapper, yeah, yeah.
I almost feel like I hate to sound conspiratorial, but I almost feel like there's a theme in media now to not own a lot of things. Or because anytime I've got a shelf of DVDs, oh, you're a hoarder. You know, that's now the social norm.
Oh, that's a very good point you bring up because I was talking to Karen last night, and there's a show she really likes called Code Black.
Mm-hmm.
She really, really enjoys it. And I said, look, I'll see if it's available and we can pick it up from the Amazon for you. The Amazon. Good grammar, Stuart. From Amazon. Anyway, I said to her, look, Code Black Season 1 is available on DVD, but Season 2 is now only via digital download. They're not putting it on disc from what I can see, and I've looked around a fair bit. And she goes, well, that's stupid. So we got into a discussion about collecting. I said, yeah, I agree. It is stupid because people out there who like to actually collect, like I collect movies and she collects TV shows a lot.
Yeah.
I said, she goes, well, what's the point of that? She goes, I'm going to have Season 1 on disc and Season 2 via digital download, which I don't watch those. So, yeah, it comes back to what you were saying about the fact that people have gotten lazier where they're just like, oh, I'm just going to click a button. I can't even bother getting up to put a disc in now. It's like, I'm just going to click a button and play it off my Apple TV or stream it off Netflix, whatever. And companies are following or setting the trend. I don't know which one it is. I don't know, you know, it's like the chicken and the egg, what came first, where they're going, eh, who bothers with disc anymore? Even though it costs them next to nothing to really put these things out.
Well, I had noticed the odd thing was, like, it used to be Warner Brothers would do these really cool menus, you know, with the visual in the background for their TV shows. And then we were purchasing the Longmire TV show, on DVD, and like it's just no frills menus. It looks like a DVR recording you would do at home.
Yeah.
And the menus you would create, they're not putting anything into it. So I kind of feel like they just really don't want, you know, portable software or any type of physical media. I really think they're trying to kill it.
I've got a couple of discs actually with no menus whatsoever.
Oh, really? Wow.
It's play only.
They're legit. Jeez.
Yeah. There, Red Rider is one of them. It's just put it in and play. I thought, okay, once the film's done, obviously there's going to be a menu. No, there's not. There's just the film and encoding details by Umbrella somebody. And then it was actually, the other one was a Paramount title, believe it or not.
That doesn't surprise me because they had a YouTube channel about a year ago where they were showing all these movies for free on YouTube. Now they've pulled them all. But it was just a weird thing that it's like they were just trying to experiment with how they could monetize it.
Yeah, put out as little as they can and try and reap back as much as they possibly can.
And I had read something, like I guess the latest Star Trek movie, they put it out on DVD, but you had to download the bonus features from the internet or something.
Yeah.
It's insane.
I've heard that as well. Batman versus Superman was another one where we bought the Blu-ray of it, the director's cut. But if you want the theatrical, actually, we got the 3D one. I think we got the 3D version, which comes with that, the director's cut. But if you want the theatrical as well, you had to download it. I'm like, I'm paying premium price anyways it is for this.
Right.
It costs you nothing to put it in. Put it in there for it. Costs you a buck to make it. Stop being
it's
so
almost like
cheap.
An experiment to see if it's worth investing.
Whether people are going to start doing it or if they're going to just ditch it and say, don't bother.
Yeah, I really feel like it's just a way to kill any that type of effort that they used to put into these. It used to be a point of pride in the early days of DVD to have all this bonus stuff.
Yeah.
That was a selling feature.
Oh,
now.
Yeah, it was all about the bullet points on the back of the box, you know?
Right. But I mean, seriously, I really do think that it's a way to demonize collecting or whatever. And maybe it's just also the way the market's going, because I always hear DVD sales are bad, Blu-ray sales have never been that great, so I it's hard to say.
You know what's going to suck as well? This is one more small point before we get back to the books, is that if you're going to, you know, say you're in a TV show, say 5 years from now,
yeah,
and, you know, you're one of the actors on the show, and 10 years from then, when your career's pretty much over, people want something to sign, how are you going to sign a digital download?
Yeah? Well, you could buy their 8x10s or whatever for... you know, $50.
Really, who does that these days? I mean, nobody bothers. You know, I'm actually surprised the convention circuit's lasted as long as it has, to be honest with you.
I've been getting notices about the Denver Comic Con, and are they bringing in our great living comic book creators? No, they're bringing in actors from failed TV shows like Firefly. We'll charge $70 for an autograph.
The Walking Dead, $90, I think it was.
Oh, yeah, The Walking Dead or Battlestar Galactica, the remake. You know, just all that type of stuff. Or somebody who played a stormtrooper, you know.
Yeah, the one who banged his head in Star Wars. Yeah, the one who cocked up.
Well, I mean, when I saw the zombie from the machete head zombie from the original Dawn of the Dead, that had his own autograph circuit that he appeared on. I was just like, it's just nuts.
It's insane. But you got to wonder as well. When you sort of blend the two together, when people go on the convention circuit, how many of them will actually get Star Trek books signed, like a novelization? Who would get the Leonard Nimoy instead of saying, "Oh, can you do the whole, you know, live long and prosper shit"? Say, "Could you sign my Star Trek book, please?" I bet you he wouldn't see that too often.
Yeah, no, I don't think he would. It'd be cool if he like drew like a naked fat woman or something in the title page.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
I've seen it every time they've people hand books to James Ellroy. When he signs them, he draws a dog. It's like an erection. Is it a name?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just it might as well make the signature unique. But yeah, I would figure a novelization. Yeah, that'd probably be a good thing to
pretty cool.
Take
I mean, yeah, it'd be something I wouldn't see too often, and you know, it's gonna outlive movies, that's for sure. You know, you get a DVD, what have they got, a shelf life of 10 years if you're lucky?
Is that what they're saying now? I haven't had one rot on me yet, but
I've actually obviously my 7 Grandmasters have rotted on me.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if my Universal Frankenstein box set rotted on me. Because two of the movies are unplayable. They have skips and freezes.
Really? I have the same one. Is that the Legacy Collection one?
Yeah, yeah. Mine's a little scruffy. I don't know why, so I'm going to have to get the Blu-ray edition to replace it.
Yeah, I was going to do that anyway.
It's the only one I've had problems with. The Dracula, the Wolfman one, no problem at all. Haven't even opened the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, the best one is the one that has the laser rot problems. Pretty much.
Yeah, of course. The one with the most consistent movies.
Like the Dracula boxes. It's okay. Yeah, really.
Yeah. How many times are you going to go back and watch, Son of Dracula? He's Alucard. Why does it sound familiar?
Yeah. I mean, the Spanish Dracula is great, but really, it hasn't got a big replayability to it.
No, because they're all gothic mood pieces and very slow burns. So you just don't tend to go back and watch those over and over again.
Yeah. But getting back to the novelizations, I remember there was one I remembered just before was the Boys in the Hood one. I had that as well.
Oh, wow. I
remember
that
having a lot more extra dialogue, not so much some more scenes, but a lot more added dialogue to it, which was pretty cool. I remember that one I've lost along the way, just moving house and all those sorts of things. Like I said, the ones I do have still are the Terminator. Oh, no, sorry, I've lost the Terminator. The Halloween and a few others in there as well that I've got.
Right.
I got off the top of my head, I can't think. But, Boys in the Hood was one. And, I mean, just I'm finding myself really getting back into these things via going into the secondhand stores because they're so cheap. Nobody wants them, really, except collectors.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like I said, the Star Trek ones were $2.50 for five. They were just throwing them. I said, please just take them all. I think they were...
Yeah, because, back before the VHS days when you could get all the Star Treks, I guess, on videotape, people bought those books like crazy as a way to relive the show when they weren't catching reruns.
Yeah, sure.
On TV. So yeah. I imagine there's a... I was actually offered my cousin. She had offered me like all of her husband's old Star Trek books from when he was a kid. I was like, I would never have the time to read those, and I'm not that big of a fan. I'm not a big enough fan to read the books.
Yeah.
And I was just like, no, donate them to a thrift store. I said, there's probably a huge shelf reserved just for those. But it was like something like 40 of them or something. It was a crazy amount.
Jeez.
But those were a big booming thing, and I would say they're probably still the biggest selling science fiction books in bookstores.
Yeah,
probably for the last 20 years.
You got to figure it's between them and the Star Wars and their expanded universe books, but
which is sad. That's the deterioration of reading, I think.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I hate to sound like a literary snob, but it's true.
Yeah, but anyway, I was saying I got back into the novelization via going to the thrift stores and coming across them very cheap and just saying, well, 50 cents or a dollar—it's a throwaway price, literally a throwaway price.
Oh yeah.
And if I read it, good. If I don't, it's not that big a deal. But also, there's a YouTube channel. I'm also, I'm critical of YouTube channels because as I watch my kids watch ones, it's always some British guy in the corner of a screen commentating over a video game. I think, I said to him this morning, I said, what do you get out of watching a grown-ass man with his little camera on himself commentating on a video game that children play? I said, well, how would you feel if I did that? He said, oh, that'd be awesome. We'd be so happy. I said, why? I said, I'm a grown man. I'm a 45-year-old man commentating on a video game that children are going to leave comments on. I said, don't you find that weird? And they're laughing, going, no. I said, well, it is, and I'm not doing it. But anyway, so there's a YouTube channel out there called Audio Books for the Damned, which I have advertised, or promoted in our Facebook page before in the past. And I think I've notified you guys about it as well. And what they've done is gotten people, amateurs, to submit their unabridged, all these are unabridged, reading of these film novelizations out there. So you can get ones like some people have done the Back to the Future series, 1, 2, and 3, and they're around about 7.5 hours or however long the book is.
Right.
And it's there for people to listen to because these books are now so hard to get. And I think it's a fantastic idea. I'm addicted to this channel. And, of course, as you know, you can actually download audio off of YouTube into an MP3 format. And I've done that with Psycho. Granted, that was not a novelization because that was an actual Robert Bloch novel before it became the film. I've got that on audiobook. I've got the Halloween 2 and 3 off of there, the audiobook readings of it, which is what I was saying before. I do now own them, but obviously not in printed format. And there's other ones on there, like The Terminator is on there, Conan the Barbarian's on there. There's just a ton of them. There's too many to think. Mad Max 2 and 3 are on there, or Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. However, Mad Max is not. Now, this is what I was saying earlier. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to find the Mad Max novel here with no luck. And the price that it goes for on eBay around about the $35-40 buck mark. I'm not paying that for a novelization.
Just oh, fuck
not,
no.
Not happening.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure if I delved hard enough or dug hard enough into some other stores, you know, sort of out of my area, yeah, I may pick it up. It may even cost me like $15 because they're going to know it's going to be hard. It's hard to find. However, what I was thinking of doing was doing an audiobook of Mad Max and submitting it to Audiobooks for the Damned. I can really lay on my accent.
It should be read by an Australian. That's the only way it works.
It really should. It's so that was my idea, because now I've got the mini studio here, and I've got mics that I've been building up over time with a mixer and headphones and all that sort of stuff. And
right.
I could just read a couple of chapters, you know, over time and just compile it and put it out as an audiobook.
Plus, you would pronounce all the Melbourne phrases correctly, if there are any in there.
Yeah, well, I'd certainly get the, you know, the lingo right.
Right.
Because I think it was, I don't remember if it was written by an Australian or an American, the novelization.
It was an Australian.
It was, okay.
Yeah. Because, you know, the Mad Max was never really, you know, the original release was just an AIP, 1 week only, flea pit.
Schlocky, yeah.
Yeah, flea pit circuit type of release. It wasn't, like the ads would give you no idea that it was anything exceptional, and but everywhere else in the world, it was a huge trend-setting hit. It's just in America, and I think we covered it on our show. But it's like it was just another AIP release. You know, I remember it being very distinctively disturbing and memorable. But and people who saw it did, but not a lot of people saw it.
Yeah, yeah. They only saw it after Mad Max 2 or Road Warrior became
right. When the Road Warrior, when Warner Brothers put that out here, then there was this. I think they actually re-released Mad Max in a lot of theaters. I think by then, AIP had become Orion Pictures or Filmways.
I was going to say, whoever owned the rights to that would have been quick to get that back in the theaters. Yeah,
they at least re-released it on the flea pit theaters.
Okay. Yeah. So that was my crazy idea, just do that and just to, you know, while away some time.
That would be awesome.
If you can stand listen to me for 5 hours at a time, whatever it is. It's
right.
But audiobooks now, let's get into audiobooks. I'm kind of a cheat because while I've really caught up on my reading, because there was a long period there where I just wouldn't read. Okay. I got lazy. I got to say, I just got very lazy. I'm like, I can't be bothered. But I got back into reading books and autobiographies and other stuff as well, like some political stuff out there. But I will sometimes get the audiobook version if I can, not every time. For instance, the Paul Stanley Facey music book, I got the audiobook because it was read by Paul Stanley.
Yeah, so it's...
yeah.
It's funny, thinking back whenever I read like an autobiography of a person that I know their voice, I tend to read those slower because I'm reading it in their voice.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's mentally, right. It's right. Like if I'm reading Superstar Billy Graham's autobiography or another pro wrestler, it's like I'm hearing him recite the book to me, you know. And with Paul Stanley, I was reading that and thinking he was Star Child, you know, explaining his story to me.
Yeah, it's like one long stage rap is the whole book. Is the
right.
One
I got a deformed ear, y'all. You know?
Yeah, pretty much.
I thought the Stooges sucked on stage. Sorry, but they did, you know. That's how I heard it.
Yeah, Iggy was wasted all the time.
It's like, Gene was not a genius, y'all.
Yeah, that's right. So anyway, I am a cheat sometimes, audiobooks. However, like the Ted Nugent books, I've got his three books and also
they're hysterical when he's reading those.
Like, oh, that God, Guns and Rock and Roll. It's like, I read it, and it's about 95% guns, 2% God, and probably about 3% rock and roll. There's a lot of... if you're a 2A enthusiast, you're going to love that fucking book. I can assure you of that. But also, his other ones like Ted White and Blue, I've got the book and I've got the audio book as well. Same with Bruce Campbell's books. I've got both audio books and also both books. So, yeah, it all depends. I want to have both formats. Some books you can't get out there in the audio book format, so I'll buy the book. Anvil's The Story of Anvil book, I bought that. I think the last one I read was Lita Ford's Living Like a Runaway, which is was disappointing, I tell you.
I heard that was bad.
It could have been so much better. I mean, the problem was with Lita Ford's book was, yeah, okay, a lot of rock stars will run around like Sammy Hagar saying, oh, I bang this woman, and Paul Stanley's guilty of that as well, and so many others out there. Well, Lita Ford does it with guys, and you got to, say, okay, well, she's a woman and she likes men, so that's fine. But the big problem was with her book was that she promised for ages, and especially on Eddie Trunk, she did an interview with him saying, when my book comes out, I'm going to expose everything about what happened with my ex-husband and how he's taken my two boys off of me, off of her, and she basically doesn't see him no more because the father said how horrible a woman she is, which I don't know. She might be, she might not. I don't know.
Right.
But when it came to that whole section, there was a footnote saying, due to the ongoing battle with trying to get custody of my children, I've decided to leave this whole section out. I thought, what the fuck was the point of this book then that you've been building up?
Yeah, she probably was told by lawyers at the last minute, you can't put that in there.
Yeah.
That's what happened. She couldn't get legal clearance for it.
Yeah, I understand, but she should have known that before she started doing the circuit saying about what's going to be in it.
Yeah, I don't think she's that bright. So that's what happened. Is she shot her mouth off before she got legal clearance.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
So that was disappointing because that was, I guess, all I wanted to read about the Runaways and her, solo career afterwards, which I enjoyed, somewhat.
Yeah.
There was all the, basically people want the juice. They want the gossip, the news about.
Right. Especially heavy metal fans.
Oh, of course,
They want it to be like, I sometimes think that's some of the underlying love for that scene in the 80s is just the crazy-ass Sunset Strip vibe.
I didn't care about her sitting there on Glenn Tipton's knee doing cocaine with him. I didn't care about her banging Richie Sambora while Bon Jovi's in the corner of the room drunk, asleep. I don't care about that sort of stuff. It doesn't interest me. It's amusing. I don't care about Tony Iommi on a plane just punching you out of nowhere and blacking out. Well, it's an awful act.
It's just the oddest, most random thing.
I mean, she's lived a life. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it is. Look, I'm not going to completely dismiss it. There are some good bits in there for sure, but the main bit that I had heard about, like I said, via the Eddie Trunk interview, it wasn't there. Whether it comes in another book another time and it promises to be just about that, I will definitely read it for sure. Dee Snider's book, while I rag on Dee, and I question Dee's motives sometimes about things that he does, Rock and Roll Christmas Tale being one of them. His book was good because it was written by him, and you could tell it was written by Dee. It wasn't a ghostwriter writing for him. So it was amusing at times.
Dee is also smart, though. Dee is actually a smart, literate guy.
Oh, he's not stupid, not by any stretch. But, it's a lot of patting on the back saying, I did this, I saved Twisted Sister, I did this, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, you did, but you also destroyed Twisted Sister, so.
Yeah, they all did. They all saved their band. They're all the hero of their band.
Paul Stanley's the same. Exactly the same. If it wasn't for me, this wouldn't have happened, and this wouldn't have happened. It's like, well, yeah, there's more pieces to the puzzle that complete the puzzle, not just one piece. Right.
Well, I think we've kind of gathered it's like he and Gene are not the coolest guys in the world, but they're the ones that stayed sober. And the other two got fucked over because they were drunks and junkies.
Drunks and cocaine addicts.
And they opened themselves up to being booted out of the band because, you can't do all that shit and be competent on the road. Not everybody is David Lee Roth.
Oh, his book is outstanding.
Yeah. And he's not even telling you barely 15%.
Oh, God, no way. No,
I mean, but his book is entertaining as hell, and you realize how he made it this long, as he balanced himself out. He might have done the coke, and the hookers, but he was also out bicycling at 5 a.m. You know, he was a health fanatic of sorts and an abuser. It was a strange balance, but he did it.
Yeah. The only problem I found with Lee Roth's book was that it started off really, really good. And it ran about two-thirds of the way, and it just became about him being Jewish. Okay, I got it. You're Jewish.
But oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He gets into that. He's going to get crazy. It's actually better to watch his David Lee Roth show. I think that actually has more autobiographical material.
Oh, the Roth show was fantastic. We've talked about it in the past. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a better look into his mentality, I think, than the autobiography, even though I liked it. But I think there's more to the Roth show that, you know, you kind of opened his mind up a bit.
Yeah. But tell me what novelizations you remember seeing around on the shelves. Not particularly, not owned by yourself, but do you remember you seeing on the bookstore shelves?
I remember a popular one was the Batman novelization for the
Tim Burton. Yes.
Craig Shaw Gardner. I think that was a huge bestseller too. And I did read it because it was the original Sam Hamm screenplay novelized, and it's a bit different. I wouldn't say it's brilliant or anything. Everybody was acting like he wrote this great script, and I just don't see it. But it's interesting. It has a few extra action scenes that are not in the movie, and which the movie was shot in a very rushed production that they had to get finished at a certain point. And this had like a scene of Batman chasing the Joker on horseback and stuff, and they didn't have time to film all that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff in there. It explains the Joker hiring henchmen to attack Batman in the church in that fight and everything. And it's got some good stuff in it, but it's not. I don't think it's essential or anything. I seriously doubt those Tim Burton movies are going to hold up if I watch them now. I tried watching the first Batman. It was just like a mess.
I liked it.
I loved Batman Returns when that was released, but I haven't seen it in 20 years. So I'm kind of hesitant to revisit a DVD, but I have heard that the Batman Forever novelization, I guess Peter David took over the series by then. Peter David based it on the first screenplay that was intended for, I think they were thinking Tim Burton would direct it. And Michael Keaton was going to replay Batman, so the script is a bit different than before Joel Schumacher took over the project.
With Val Kilmer, yeah.
Yeah, if people want to check that out. I've heard it's just like Conan the Destroyer, and that's one I used to see around. That was written by Robert Jordan, and it's based on the first screenplay, which was by Roy Thomas and Gary Conway, which didn't have as much goofy stuff in it and was a bit more like a straightforward sword and sorcery story.
Didn't have Arnold punching the camel?
Right. It didn't have any of the goofy stuff or the Tracy Walter comedy or, you know, Mako being goofy, apparently, or, you know, the jokes about Grace Jones talking about grabbing a man by the balls or whatever.
That's cool.
It was just a straightforward, apparently different enough that people say it's actually a pretty good read. I've never checked it out myself.
Getting back to that Batman book you were talking about, I think I may have owned the book. I don't remember. I know I owned the audiobook cassette read by Roddy McDowell, but that was abridged because the whole thing only ran 90 minutes from memory. if I see those cassettes or whatever and they're abridged, I just don't want to touch them. I did mistakenly buy the audiobook of Steve Martin's Born Standing Up, and I think that is abridged. I'm like, ah, shit, why did I buy it? I can't remember why I did that.
I can tell you the first one I read was the Rambo First Blood Part 2 novelization, which was by David Morrell. And what he did was he took the James Cameron screenplay and kind of made it his own and filled in gaps about Rambo's life that were never in the movies. And also he had to continue the story, even though he killed Rambo in the previous First Blood book.
Yeah, that's right.
But that novelization is actually really good. Like, it was actually exciting and very well done.
I'll have to hit my local bookstores around the city and just further out of the city to see if I can snag some more.
I've heard his Rambo 3 novelization is terrific.
It couldn't be any worse than the film. Like, the film's not.
The movie's pretty bad. But yeah. It's by the way, it's getting my. It's part of DVD shelf purge this week that I'm doing. So
pro Afghanistan, we stand by Afghanistan.
Yeah, exactly.
Rambo 3. Oh, okay.
Yeah, these days I'm rooting for the Russians. I don't care what the hell they do. It's just Yeah. Plus the goofy beginning where Rambo is having a stick fight with Jewish kickboxer Harold Diamond from Florida playing a...
Oh, my goodness.
Who was Harold Nature Boy Roth in Florida back in the 70s and changed his name to Harold Diamond professionally and basically replaced, I think it was James Liu, the Chinese-American martial artist who recently choreographed the fights on the Luke Cage TV show. But James Liu was fired for Rambo 3 and then spoofed that role in Hot Shots Part 2. He's the one fighting Charlie Sheen.
Oh.
Where they're making fun of that scene, it's James Liu, who was fired by Stallone. Also the first director of that film was fired, too, Russell Mulcahy. Mm. I know the Sly Cast did an episode about it and talked about its troubled production.
Yes.
Which is highly recommended.
But I've been checking the Kindle store to see if these things are sort of making a comeback via that, but no, it's not. Not happening.
Yeah, in the day and age of movies just hitting video, home video so quick now, mm-hmm. I don't even see if there's probably very little of a market for novelizations.
No, I mean, like the older ones, like the Back to the Future trilogy. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Reissuing. Well, also, just because you can go buy the movie for $5 at Walmart in a bin, you know, do you want a novelization?
Yeah, I get what you're saying, but there's also, as we've been talking about, extra parts there where you got to use your imagination because you've not seen it before. So,
right. Well, there. What I would think is if they're written by genre writers who have a following, like Max Allen Collins or Peter David or David Morrell, you know, then people would seek those out and they still have a market, and those tend to stay in print. But if they're written by somebody like there was this guy, I think his name was Joel Norst. And he wrote the novelizations, if I remember correctly, because it's all off the top of my head, Delta Force and Lethal Weapon. And
oh boy.
I don't think he wrote anything else after those novelizations, but he wrote like some action movie novelizations, probably wrote more than I remember. And like the Lethal Weapon novelization, I remember, had the ending where Riggs quits the police force and opens up a karate school in the ghetto.
See, that's what I'm getting at. It's this... things like that where you go, oh, this is not how it finishes in Lethal Weapon, the film, so you got to now, you know, use the theater of the mind to sort of play it out. And it's the,
right.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
maybe that was Shane Black's first screenplay. Maybe that's how his screenplay ended, and they just decided not to film that for the movie because it didn't open the door for a sequel, which I don't think Shane Black ever really wanted. So.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I can see why. I mean, Lethal Weapon 2 is perfectly fine, but I mean,
yeah. Oh boy, it did not hold up when I watched it again.
Yeah, well, I've not seen it a long
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I don't recommend revisiting. I say stick with your youthful memories of it.
Right. I remember 3 story. Just being a complete mess, and 4, it was like, eh, seen it, that's perfectly fine.
Right. Yeah. Well, the an interesting thing about novelizations, I was thinking about this, is in the 1960s, when they did the Mike Henry Tarzan movie, Tarzan and the Valley of Gold, they had Fritz Leiber write the novelization. Mm-hmm. And Fritz Leiber is a very was a well-respected classic fantasy novelist. And everybody says his Tarzan novel was so good that they could just put it in the continuity with the Edgar Rice Burroughs original 23 novels or whatever, and it would fit right in. And some people thought it was actually a better Tarzan book than anything Burroughs had written. I don't know about that, but I'd love to get a hold of it and read it. Because the movie is fun, but it's not like a great film. But it's a fun action movie for the 60s.
Tell me about Doc Savage, Man of Bronze. Was that film, was that based on a previous book, or was that written for the screen, that story?
It was based on elements from 2 different Doc Savage stories, and mostly the first novel, Man of Bronze. But I recently read Man of Bronze to my kid for bedtime stories, and was surprised how much stuff wasn't used in the movie that would have been incredible. And which made me realize, I mean, Warner Brothers just wanted a cheap, quickie production. But there's stuff in that book that there's a snake pit scene that predates Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's probably where the screenwriters for Raiders of the Lost Ark got the idea.
Oh, for sure.
There's Doc Savage diving in the water and punching out a shark. I mean, there's all this cool stuff that could have been done in the film, and they didn't bother. They eliminated all those elements that were really fantastic and action-packed. And the villain, Captain Seas, apparently came from a different story that I haven't read yet.
Did they blatantly rip off Fortress of Solitude for Superman from Doc Savage?
Yeah, yes, they did. Yeah,
that was totally talk about shameless.
I know, and that's what disappoints me about that George Powell production is, like, they had the potential to basically do Raiders of the Lost Ark and Superman the movie years before with Doc Savage in, like, 1975, whenever they made it. Yeah. And they didn't. They just said, oh, it's a cheap production. Make it campy like the Batman TV show. Nobody wants this to be straightforward. Screw this. And completely messed it up. And a lot of potential lost there. Unbelievable what they could have done with it.
Mm.
Yeah, but yeah, the novelization that they issued was basically reprinting the Man of Bronze, the first Doc Savage story.
Okay.
If you find the tie-in edition, because I used to have it.
Mm. Okay, well, I wasn't sure if there was written for the screen, then a novel written afterwards.
Yeah, you know what's weird is the James Bond movies, like when they had Christopher Wood do novelizations for Moonraker and The Spy Who Loved Me, even though Ian Fleming wrote those novels in the 50s.
Really? But
the movies were so different, they let Chris Wood, who was originally a novelist, write the novelizations to tie them in more with the movies.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, it's really weird. It also baffled me when they did a John Carter novelization, when you could just buy a Princess of Bars, but the movie was different enough where they could justify hiring some science fiction writer to do a novelization, like a new story.
Yeah,
which is that was a little odd to me, but I mean that's the way their business is run now.
Do you know what else got a novelization, John?
What's that?
The A-Team.
Oh, the recent Joe Carnahan movie?
No, the TV show back in the 80s.
Oh, I remember the TV show had like a series of books packaged like an action, a men's adventure paperback series.
I wonder if there was any Columbo ones. I should look it up. If there was any Columbo novels.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, because books were, you know, almost as normal entertainment as television, so it would not surprise me at all. And it seems like every... you know, detective series or whatever seemed to have tie-in novelizations. I think Kojak had a few. You had mentioned Starsky and Hutch, The Professionals, our favorite, that had a series of books issued in England.
Oh, wow. Look, John, I'm looking it up. There is a site called Columbo Site, and they got all the Columbo books in there, and there's one for Any Old Port in the Storm.
Oh,
a faithful novel version of the outstanding third season episode, teleplay by Stanley Ralph Frost, story by Larry Cohen. Wow, I've got to try and get my hands on that, if any.
Well, but to me, the appeal of Columbo is watching the actors play off of each other. So it's I don't know if that would carry over into novelizations. But.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but there's also if they can put in extra information in there,
right?
I'd be more than happy to.
Give you a Rob Zombie version and tell you all this excessive stuff about Pleasance's childhood.
I'm sure it'd be written a lot better than a Rob Zombie anything.
But yeah, there's that backstory obsession, you know, that it seems to come with new filmmakers when they do remakes. It's like, well, I want to explore this avenue that the original film didn't talk about.
But like, I don't remember any Columbo episodes with long-haired hippies saying F every 2 seconds and, heavy metal music all plastered over the episode. So
you didn't see the one with Sid Haig as the guilty villain.
Oh, is that where Columbo meets the Firefly
Jerry
family?
Was the red herring?
Please.
But it's funny because I was watching the John Wayne movie McHugh, which doesn't hold up too great. It's actually weirdly unique because of the Seattle locations. But it was originally written for a different actor, like a Clint Eastwood or Steve McQueen, and it's just a total bullet ripoff. But the novelization was based on a first screenplay before it was rewritten for John Wayne, and apparently contains a lot of details that seem to be hinted at in the movie, because the movie feels like it's a sequel because all these characters have backstories they refer to, but we as viewers know nothing about it. So it's a little mystifying watching it, but I guess the novelization must fill in some gaps there.
Yeah.
Or also that movies back then didn't really care. Like, they just kind of threw you in the middle of the story. They didn't obsess over giving you the entire history of a character, so it could be that as well.
Just for a bit of an FYI for everybody out there, if you want to really get serious into the books, there's a site called Abe Books, ABEBOOKS, .com or .co.uk. I forgot which, but you look in Abe Books, and it literally has every effing book available for sale and where they're from. It's just unbelievable. But, yeah, that's just a bit of an FYI for you. Anything else you want to bring up about these, John?
Well, I was thinking that, okay, like, there's a King... This is how weird it is. There will be, like, a... there's a King Kong novelization from the 1930s that I think Edgar Wallace wrote, if I'm not mistaken. And then I think they did a novelization for the De Laurentiis remake.
They would have done for sure.
And then I think they did one for King Kong Lives, if I'm not mistaken. So... It's funny, but I was wondering if there's a Skull Island novelization since I got a new one out.
Huh. Interesting, yeah. Or if there was one for the Peter Jackson from 06, whatever it was.
Yeah, I was curious about that, because that's, even though it's a probably way too faithful remake of the 1930s film, but it's also expands and bloats it in its own way, and would easily lead to a completely different novelization from the Edgar Wallace version. Well, and also Escape from New York is one that I used to see all the time in used bookstores in the 80s and never picked it up. Mike McQuay wrote it. The late Mike McQuay was a science fiction writer. And apparently it became a highly sought after collector's item because it explained that entire world of 1997. McQuay actually, I think, came up with his own stuff to explain why things turned out the way they did in that dystopian future. And I guess a lot of Plissken's backstory was in there.
Yeah.
Okay. It's probably on Audiobooks of the Damned if I look for it.
Quite possibly, yeah. Quite possibly.
Yeah, I may have to record my own Crazy from the Heat with David Lee Roth in my David Lee Roth impression. So.
No, I think they only take novelizations because they're not allowed to take whatever.
Oh, yeah, copyright
issues.
Yeah. These novelizations probably go out of print quicker than anything.
They do. Looking here, there is a Kong Skull Island official movie novelization just came out about 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it would totally make sense. Especially if they did one for Godzilla. It's the same producer, so they're gonna do that.
Yep. But, good ratings as well, and like four or five out of five. So yeah, it's, looks alright.
It's just like seeing it in IMAX, but somebody reads it to you.
Yeah, well, I've got one here for Alien Covenant. So it looks like there's a few War for the Planet of the Apes Revelations novelizations. So they're out there.
Yeah.
Just they're not marketing them, because when I go into bookstores, I never see them at all. Now it's all about biographies, about bloody sports, you know, celebrities. Well, they got a book called My Story. I was like, wow, would it take you 3 seconds to come back? My Story, you know, this is me. I mean, I don't care. Just... I'm not interested. Don't flood my bookstores with that shit. Not interested.
Well, I was thinking of there was a Harold Robbins novel called The Carpetbaggers, and
yeah.
A character in there was Nevada Smith, and then they later made a Steve McQueen movie about Nevada Smith, and I was baffled by that because I was like, well, how could they just take a character out of Harold Robbins' book and then just create a whole movie around him that's this big revenge story? And I asked James Ulroy about it because he's read The Carpetbaggers a dozen times. He says what happened was Nevada Smith's story is told in one of the chapters of the book. And what they did was they basically just had a screenwriter adapt that chapter into a full-length movie because it was so popular and made it a vehicle for McQueen. I went, wow. So I said that's almost like if somebody took chapters of L.A. Confidential that were not filmed in for the movie and made another movie out of it. He goes, exactly. Because they own the rights to the book, they can do that.
They did that with Dracula's Daughter from 38, I think it was. Might have been a bit earlier. They took an omitted chapter.
Right.
That was not filmed for Dracula and made that into Dracula's Daughter.
Yeah. It's unique how they do that. It's funny you mention, like, Dracula's Daughter. The Hammer movies were getting these reissued novelizations by recent versions by writers like, I guess, Ramsey Campbell and Sean Hudson, which I thought was unique. But then I was also reminded that a lot of those early 60s European horror films, like I think some of the Hammer films, and I know the movie Conga, and I think Gorgo, and even Reptilicus had pornographic novelizations by a publishing house in the early 60s in America.
Jeez.
They go for insane money. Like, I have seen them, like, I saw some in a bookstore in Toronto. They're going for, like, $90 Canadian. But they're extremely hard to come by. I guess Conga has some subplot about a love affair with a trapeze artist. And I mean, it's just like, or no, see, or the wife, Michael Gow's wife in the film is getting it on with the gardener. Or so, you know, they just have these.
Lord.
You know, back then you got your smut from prose. You couldn't get it, you know, in the theaters or, you know, unless you belong to a certain photography club or 8mm club or whatever. So it was in these books. And so, yeah, Conga and I guess Reptilicus. I don't know how the hell they worked sex scenes into Reptilicus, but apparently they did. So there's a unique little chapter in novelizations for you. I think the company's name was Monarch House, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
People can look into that. We'll try to find a Google link or something about those.
Sure, sure.
I just remember hearing about those. I was like, how could this possibly exist? It's like, who is the market? Because those monster movies are, you know, those were marketed to kids in the early 60s. Adults didn't want to see Reptilicus.
Yeah. Yeah. It's insane. Well, I think we'll wrap this up shortly. I am going to put a link in the show notes to audiobooks for The Damned. I highly suggest you go check them out and give them a listen and subscribe to their channel. I mean, they're not paying us to do this. They're not asking us. This is strictly me saying I really think you should check it out. And if you want a bit of nostalgia, you know, download one of their episodes or one of their books and keep yourself entertained for the next 5-6 hours, whatever it is. Some go even longer than that.
Check them out before they get shut down by the man, because I could see YouTube videos getting a big closure.
Yeah, I think what it is, they do put in there for educational purposes only, so I think that's how they get around any sort of copyright litigation with these things. And, I mean, these were books written by hired guns. Hey, just knock out a novelization of this film. Here's the film, watch it, and that's it. I don't think the author's too attached to it, you know, 30-something years later that they're going to get.
Yeah, it's work for hire.
It totally is.
It worked for hire. Completely.
But, like I said, they're read by amateurs, but the guy who did the Psycho one, you'd swear he was a professional, because he's really good with his voice, changing of voices, you know, to suit a woman, and also the way he reads. You know, it's not just him reading and, you know, with no stops and, you know, so not in a monotone way is what I'm getting at. It's right. But, I find them quite good when I've got no podcast to listen to. I've got some I can always go back to on the iTunes, just pop them in and keep myself entertained.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But
instead of listening to some Rare Live Deep Purple Sides.
Or Led Zeppelin Live in Long Beach in 1973. I don't care, you know.
Yeah, I'm actually at a point I just don't listen to as much music as I used to. I started putting music CDs back in my car like a couple of weeks ago, and I realized I hadn't done this in forever.
I do still listen to music, music albums at work, obviously, because as you guys know, for my job, I'm on the road a lot for work.
Right.
So I've got to keep myself, you know, entertained. I can't just look at the damn highways. And so, I will listen to them, but predominantly it's podcasts. And, there's another podcast I had to just unsubscribe from because they put out a PSA. Get this, John. They put out a PSA against racism, homophobia, and Islamophobia.
Oh, God.
I thought this is a joke.
You know, I'll give them the racism. I'll give them the homophobia. But I won't give them the Islamophobia.
Really? I mean, okay.
I'll cut them some slack on the first two, of course. But it's still, like, the most uninvolving thing you could say.
It really is. Yeah. So
why is it considered brave to say you're anti-racist? Like, we've all been saying that for decades. It's not a new viewpoint, you know.
Yeah.
Right. It is. It just isn't. It's old. It's old. Watch stuff from the 70s. God, Lord, it's constant lecturing.
Oh God, yeah.
Moralizing, you know.
Yeah, but I had to. No, I just unsubscribed. Like,
you don't want to. You don't want to name them here, do you?
Nah, it's not going to do any good. It's not going to work. Yeah.
I know. Luckily, I don't listen to any film podcasts. It's nothing personal.
It's not a film podcast, by the way. No,
nothing personal to our film friends. It's just I don't want to be inspired because I could end up, you know, ripping them off or something.
Yeah. You like to be as original as we possibly can. I think us talking about books and these novelizations is some sort of proof of that.
Yeah, and I actually encourage other shows to do episodes on novelizations because I think it's a given for most movie buffs to have read a few, and it's a pretty interesting topic in its own.
I think, honestly, just go read. Yeah, whether you read them or you read autobiographies or you read stories about World War II or whatever your fascination is, just go and read. Get off the TV. Get off the couch. Stop watching TV.
Yeah,
you know, I encourage my kids to read. I mean, they got a ton of books. I mean, I'll never knock back buying them a book when they ask. Never. Yeah, you know, my kids will read the stuff like The Diary of a Wimpy Kid or the they got the Harry Potter box set and also the I think it's Captain Underpants.
Captain Underpants is pretty huge.
Yeah, yeah. But they got a ton of books, and Dr. Seuss is another one. One of my sons got. Like the Dr.
It's funny
because
my son was taken on a road trip to Texas, and our wife's like, "Well, we've got the Harry Potter audiobook of the first, you know, that he's read and he's seen the movie." And I offered them an audiobook of Doc Savage stories, and she wouldn't take it because like, she has to listen to it. So I was like, "Oh well, he might like it." But yeah, I encourage reading. I'm getting to a point where I'd rather read than watch a movie or television. So
yeah.
It's just. You know, I'm tired of the glare of the TV and, you know, with the revival series at the Alamo, I'm just like, you know, I'd much rather see an old movie in a theater. It's like such a more, like today I went to a double feature of two old 50s crime films and I'm like, this is the way to watch these. I wouldn't appreciate these on television.
Nah,
you know,
not at all.
It's better just focus on a giant screen. You can't beat it. But I think reading's just a lot. It's better for you in general. In fact, I think for our artwork for this week, we should have that reading bookworm that you always find in different clip art.
Yeah. I'm going to watch The Treasure of Sierra Madre on my iPhone, man.
Yeah.
I don't think
so. You know, how can you even say that? Oh, I'm going to watch Lawrence of Arabia on, you know, on my
7-inch portable player. Yeah.
On my mini pad. It's like, what?
What are you doing? Yeah.
Don't. Why? But, they're not. Oh, you're going to watch Good, the Bad, and the Ugly that way? You're going to watch.
Oh, get the hell out of here. Yeah.
The Searchers that way? It's fucking crazy. Oh, I'm going to watch The Bullet Car Chase on my phone.
I'm going to watch The Wild Bunch on YouTube on my phone. Get the fuck out of here now. Nuts.
I mean, it's insane. I can't even imagine it. It's just read a book.
Yeah. Read a book, we say. I've found myself doing that a lot. I just bought 2 Kiss books. Off the iTunes store. To get them in would have cost me a damn arm and a leg. In the print format, I mean. And not in the stores here. So I thought, well, I got an iPad now. They are for like $16 and $20 respectively on iTunes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to buy off that. I had a stack of iTunes credit. Because every time iTunes cards go down 20% off, I just buy like $50 worth and pop them on the account. And they get used when they get used. And, well, I had a stack of money on there. I was like, well... Stuff it. I'm just going to buy these 2 books. And I'm thoroughly enjoying the one I'm reading now, which is the Making of the Kiss solo albums. It's a really good read. It's very interesting.
Well, the Kiss fans are pretty extreme. You're getting as bad as Stooges fans, you know, because I remember wasting my money on Stooges bootlegs. You know, Iggy and the Stooges, 1971, at some Hollywood club, and it's like recorded with a Sears tape recorder or something.
Oh, Lord.
And it just sounded like hell. But yeah, that was a common thing, and it's like now I'm seeing it spread to these very popular groups like Kiss, and you know, I guess the Led Zeppelin bootleg craze has kind of gone down.
I'll tell you a band who had a massive bootleg craze was Tangerine Dream.
Really? Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. They are born to be a cult band.
And I forgot I'd bought one of their albums, a best of Tangerine Dream off of iTunes, God, years ago. I'm like, it's got some good stuff on here that I actually enjoy.
Yeah, I actually miss those guys doing film scores, because at least they were always memorable.
Oh, yeah, they were, yeah.
Like, Sorcerer is just a thief or just great scores, and it's like that's kind of a lost art.
Well, it's like Risky Business. I mean, it's a decent film, but it gets pushed way over the edge as a much better film with the Tangerine Dream score.
Oh, yeah, it totally enhances it. If that was scored by, Sammy Hagar or somebody. It's like it would.
Yeah, like a wall to wall MTV soundtrack. Yeah.
Right. It would not be remembered at all. I mean, it was unique for it to have a Bob Seger song that was like 6 years old by the time that was made.
Yeah.
you know, on the soundtrack. That was already unique. That was like a 1978 tune or something, 79.
Okay.
And it's yeah, it's like every song on that soundtrack was not current. Like Bad to the Bone, the Thorogood song, that was like 2 or 3 years old by the time it was used in the movie. Yeah. If that was on there. I mean, well, there was a Muddy Waters tune used on that soundtrack that was like 30, 40 years old. So. It's that movie, the soundtrack kind of broke the rules. That's not a very respected thing these days. But
I'll tell you what, John, there's a show for us in the future. The Lost Art of the Soundtrack.
Yeah.
Because they used to be huge. I remember back in the... Well, I remember as a kid back in the teenage years from the 80s, definitely through the 90s. I remember having the Goodfellas soundtrack on vinyl, for God's sake.
Yeah, I was a big collector of Ennio Morricone soundtracks back when they were really hard to find.
Right, right.
And, I mean, now you can just download 100 gigabytes off of a torrent and you get everything he ever did. But back then, you had to hunt for that stuff.
I remember when I bought the Taxi Driver soundtrack on CD, like from this sort of real hippie-ish store. The guy goes, dude, you just picked the best album in the whole store. I'm going to give you a discount on this. I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. It's overpriced as it is. There should be a discount on it, you hippie fuck.
Well, I remember when I went to our hippie store in Jackson, Mississippi, and I said, is there a CD of Ennio Morricone's spaghetti westerns? And the guy just like, I don't know, let me ask. And he goes and he asks the old hippie right at the place. He goes, I don't know, man, but that would be the shit. And then he looked it up on his inventory. Yeah, we got it over here. And they dug it out for me. And I played that CD like 1,000 times. It was just a sort of his greatest spaghetti western themes or whatever tracks. And then Rhino started issuing that stuff more seriously a few years later. And then you could get the stuff from Italy. They were, you know, Sicilian Clan and Violent City and all that stuff. You know, it was left and right coming out.
Yeah. But I think there's definitely a topic for us in the future. Soundtracks and a lost art of.
Oh, God, is it? Is it ever? When's the last time you came out of the theater humming the music from the movie?
I don't know.
Really,
I don't know.
It's been years.
There's no more love for a soundtrack these days. I mean, the last compilation soundtrack I think I knew of that was really popular was the Studio 54. I think it had a couple of volumes to it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was what?
I have the first one, which I actually thought was a pretty good soundtrack. I've never seen the movie.
Was there a second one? I think there might have been a second one. I know the Commitments, definitely back from 91 or 92, had two volumes to it.
I tell you, one I love was City of God. It had all this Brazilian music that was, you know, it was unique and to hear that in America. So there was a lot of tracks out there. I don't know how much was originally done for the movie because some of it sounded like it was 70s kind of psychedelic disco funk music from Brazil.
Well,
which kind of got me into Brazilian music. I ended up getting a ton of it. Like Paul Nice told me what to look for and stuff and directed me to some good stuff.
I tell you, there's a guy we should have on the show, either Paul or Scheme, about this stuff. That's right up their alley.
Good Lord, Scheme and Paul could probably just, man, go.
Hey, easy show for us. We can just sit back and listen.
Exactly.
That'd be good.
Because Scheme will talk about the... that library of, I forget their name, you know, I'm blanking on the name, but their music was used in Shaw Brothers films and spaghetti westerns and British films and stuff, and it's just all these.
Oh, man, they love their martial arts and their British spy stuff, those two.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing all the what comes out of it. I mean, Paul's gotten so good with the mixing, he's got like a yacht rock mix. Using like late 70s, like cocaine and houseboat music. Yeah, that was the last mix he put up on his Bandcamp page. It was mind blowing. It was so damn good. I mean, it was almost as good as his Shaw Brothers mix.
That was fucking great.
I have turned so many people onto that, and they're like, "This is the greatest thing I've ever heard in my life."
Yeah, yeah, but I was thinking about pulling a trick on Scheme and saying, hey, can you come on our new podcast that me and John and Hunter are doing? Because the MMC is no longer. It's called the Nostalgia Kings. He fucking flips out. He will not be happy about that.
I'm surprised he doesn't do his own podcast. I guess if he wasn't traveling around the world so much.
Oh, God, yeah. That guy is racked up more frequent fly points than anybody on the planet, I think.
Yeah, I don't know anybody who I told him one time, and this is just I'd only known him for a few months. I was like, man, you get around more than James Bond. It's just he's all over the place.
Yeah, that's right. He and I got a little stoush about politics. I thought, oh, okay, I'll stop it now because Scheme's starting to get upset, but it was all good.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right, well, we'll wrap it up for this week. Not sure if the boy's back next week. He may be, he may not. And go read a good book.
Yeah.
That's what we say. Go read a good book. Get the fuck up off your ass. Stop watching TV. Even though I'm about to sit down now and watch Stormplay on TV, I'm sort of contradicting myself, but you don't know that unless I haven't said anything. But go read a good book. I mean, that's me personally, I like to just say, right, I'm going to just disappear for a few hours. Dad's going to read. I'll pull up my iPad and just read. And I'm happy. Yeah, it's perfectly fine for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, it's like old-time radio. Gets your brain working.
Blue coal charcoal. Or blue charcoal, whatever it is.
Yeah, blue coal.
Yeah.
It's like Brooks Brothers Suits sponsors The Shadow.
Yeah. But anyway, as we said, we're going to put a link up to the Audiobooks of the Damned. Go check them out. And I'll put a link up to A-Books as well for you guys if you are so inclined to go check them out. You may be surprised what's out there. That's for sure. So on that note, I'll imitate Hunter as always when he's not here and say adios.
I will say Magadon.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.